Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Stone Chapel, a podcast of the staff and friends of the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, Texas. My name is David Capes. I'm the Senior Research Fellow at the Library and your host for this series of podcasts. Our purpose is fairly simple. We want to bring to you great conversations with leading experts from around the world on biblical, theological, historical, and archaeological themes. Well, the list goes on. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Joining me today on the Stone Chapel is Dr. Clint Burnett. He has a PhD from Boston College. He's an expert in material culture, and particularly the inscriptions that the ancients left behind and how those can help us understand the world, the culture, the people who gave us the New Testament. He's written a terrific new book. I'd recommend it. You can find it at the Lanier Theological Library, entitled Studying the New Testament Through Inscriptions, An Introduction, published by Hendrickson Academic. Dr. Clint Burnett, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here today. Thank you very much.
All right, let's start at the very beginning. Studying the New Testament through inscriptions. What is an inscription for those who don't know?
Well, an inscription would be a message that is engraved, scratched, written, most often on a durable surface. So we're talking the most common are stone, but there's also inscriptions that are attested on things like bone, lead, pottery, those types of things. But also graffiti, ancient graffiti, which necessarily wasn't scratched or written on a durable surface, gets lumped in there with inscriptions. So it covers a lot, basically.
But it's on a surface that lasts, right? I mean, as we were talking earlier, I'm surrounded by probably 1,000 books in my little home office, and I doubt most of those will last, right? But there are things in our world that do last. What kind of things would become inscriptions 1,000 years from now?
Well, 1,000 years from now, our inscriptions would be our tombstones. That's our most common experience that we have today with inscriptions would be tombstones. Maybe if your church was dedicated at a particular year, you'll find an inscription on the side of the church that sort of marks the church's building or the church's dedication, those types of things. We don't live in a civilization that used inscriptions like the ancient world. The ancient world, the best epigrapher of all time, his name is Louis Robert, he was a Frenchman. He characterized the Greco-Roman world as a civilization of epigraphy. And epigraphy is just a synonym for an inscription. And it's so interesting because we know that other cultures used inscriptions or inscriptions, people study the Old Testament used to interpret the Old Testament, but it's the number of inscriptions that have been left behind from the Greco-Roman world almost anywhere from 500,000 to 800,000 inscriptions have been left behind. And so that's just a fragment of what existed. The majority of those are things that are written on stone. The most common, like our inscriptions today, would be tombstones, those types of things. But you'll find inscriptions that are written on gateways, on buildings as dedications, on altars. You'll find inscriptions that are scratched on walls. You'll find inscriptions on lead collars that they put around slaves, which is a really interesting thing.
Wow.
Giving the name of the slave and the person who owns the slave evidently was around the slave's neck. And so you have inscriptions that are of their own bone, inscriptions that are on wood that have survived in either a boggy climate or a very dry climate.
I remember a few years ago at the Lanier Theological Library, we had the Copper Scroll at our library, which comes from Qumran. I think it's a one-off. I don't think there's any other copper scrolls. But copper last, of course, and they were scratched into it a message, and a very interesting message at that. But yeah, the ancient world was full of it. I remember going through Ephesus a few years ago, and you're just walking through the city, and you see all these pillars, and you see all these bits of stone, and you see letters on every one of them. And some are in Greek, some are, as I recall, were in Latin. And they're just everywhere. So what is it that inscriptions tell us that something like a manuscript would not? We know the texts come to us both in inscriptions and in manuscripts. It's a bit more complicated than that. But people wrote manuscripts like manuscripts of Mark or manuscripts of the Book of Romans. What can you learn from an inscription that you can't learn from other manuscripts?
Well, so the biggest thing that you can learn about inscriptions would, or about life from inscriptions rather, would be just how more average everyday people in the Greco-Roman world lived. So you can see decrees that cities passed, laws and legislations that they passed. You can see the jobs that people had from their tombstones and those types of things. So we can see the that we can see names sometimes from the tombstones. We can see what occupation they had, sometimes how they died, whether or not it was in a gladiatorial combat. Mm-hmm. There's a great inscription where a guy's like, you know, I spared my opponent and then I turned around and he gave me a fatal death blow. And that's how the inscription reads.
Wow.
Yeah. So there are inscriptions that really give us insight. And this is the best place, I think, where inscriptions sort of help us to reconstruct the cities in which the first Christians lived, in that inscriptions are sometimes our only way that we can reconstruct the local cults and deities that were worshipped in particular cities, because these people who lived in these cities, they would leave inscriptions to the gods of those particular cities. So we can reconstruct local cults and customs and laws from inscriptions, things that some people who wrote texts took for granted. And these things, in my opinion, can help us to elucidate a text like Acts chapter 19, where Paul is in Ephesus, and the importance of Artemis. It can help us to figure out, just reconstruct in a contextual way that all the surviving literary sources, which aren't necessarily produced. It's kind of hard to sometimes pinpoint, well, this text was written at this particular place, this particular time, by this particular person. But right. We can do that with an inscription a lot. Not all the time, but a lot.
Yeah. So how do you date these things? I mean, you know, you have an inscription, it's in, let's say, Latin, or it's in Greek. How can you date it exactly? Because Latin is being spoken for a long time and by a lot of people. Same thing with Greek. How can you pinpoint it exactly?
So there are several ways. Some inscriptions, thank the Lord, actually give the date.
That always helps, right?
That really helps. Yeah. Some have been, especially in the latter part of the 20th century, as the science of archaeology has progressed, some inscriptions have been found in a closed scientific excavation. And so what you can do is you can use all of the materials, the material culture, specific pottery and those types of things that are found around the inscription to sort of date it. So the thing that comes to mind is the famous Theodotus inscription, which is from Jerusalem, which is the only inscriptional evidence that we have for a Second Temple Jewish synagogue. It was dated in that way. It was found in a cistern. It was evidently thrown in there in a cistern, rather. And in this cistern, all of the materials around it all dated to the Second Temple period, the late Second Temple period. So we're talking first century BC up into the up until AD 70. And so the people who dug that and excavated that were able to figure out, well, this inscription most likely dates to this particular time. And then the third way is you would, just like you would use a New Testament manuscript and you would date the manuscript by the paleography, you can date inscriptions by the forms of the letters. Now, it's not an exact science, but epigraphers, people who study inscriptions and specialize in them, what they can do is they can study letter forms from a particular city or a particular region, and that will help them to get a more secure dating through paleographical means.
Yeah, in manuscripts, I've often thought about how different my grandmother's signature is from my own. And she had a unique way of making the letter R in cursive writing that nobody does anymore. And if you knew the period, if you knew that, then you could say, well, yeah, she was writing probably somewhere in the mid-1940s or 50s or something like that. But it, and when you look back, you know, at maybe something like the Declaration of Independence, you realize, gosh, look at how they were writing, how they were spelling words and all those kind of things. So yeah, it's inexact, but still it gives us a ballpark figure, plus or minus 50 years, let's say, to be able to pinpoint some of these things. One of the things I love about your book is that you took all your own photography. You didn't have to pay for these photos. You did that yourself, which is great. I loved it.
Yeah. I've been to Turkey twice. I've been to Greece once. I've been to Israel three or four times. I've been to Italy once. I take pictures every time I go. My wife, God bless her, she just sits there and puts up with me. She knows part of family vacations are going to be traipsing over archaeological sites and going through museums. She's gotten to where now that she knows what to look for. And so she can spot stuff. And I've got her on the prowl too, because we're both there. We know we have only a finite amount of time and we're in a museum. And I'm like, if you find this, if you find that, just let me know. And split up. And then she comes and gets to me and said, let's take this picture. So you
have a companion in that, at least, right?
Indeed, a companion in crime.
Indeed. The graffiti. I love the stuff that you talk about with the graffiti. You know, when we see graffiti, we think of gang signs and we think of trains being painted, those kinds of things. Which, in the ancient world, did they do the same sort of thing?
Well, not particularly. So it's so fascinating. It's only been in the latter part of the 20th century that scholars have really started to reevaluate graffiti. When people were excavating Pompeii, they found all of this graffiti, and there's this really renowned German archaeologist named Mao. And Mao has this great quote about how basically these are the dregs of society, these people who are putting these, that are writing graffiti on walls. But the interesting thing is that if scholars have gone back to look at these, they've seen things like, well, it's interesting that we've got graffiti in dining rooms of the most elite homes that we've ever found, that we have people who could actually write are the ones who are writing graffiti, that we have people who are writing things like verses from Homer, verses from Virgil, and other literary works like those. And so people begin to reevaluate to say that really graffiti is not, I mean, just everybody did it. It seems to be a pan-Mediterranean phenomenon, and that people of all social classes participated in it. We have from graffiti, we'll have things like grocery lists. We'll have prices. We'll have, there are, especially from Pompeii, you can sort of work out what things cost. There are graffiti like you'd find in a bathroom. There's a lot of sexual graffiti from Pompeii, and there are books that are written just about that, which is very sad about exploitation, those types of things. But there are male and female prostitutes that are mentioned in these graffiti. You'll find discussions of gladiators and, you know, scorekeeping of who won this match and who won that match and those types of things. And so they really, it spans the gamut. There's a lot there with ancient graffiti. Just goes to show that that weren't just the dregs of society that were producing these.
Well, that leads me to wonder about reading. I mean, who could read this graffiti? What I mean, are we talking about most people could read it, most people couldn't read it? You know, I've heard all sorts of different numbers and percentages about what literacy is and who could have really. But when you have so much of it, it makes it seem like a lot of people could probably read and write.
Yeah, so there's a lot of great work that's being done on the question of ancient literacy with inscriptions and graffiti, especially. There was a modern movement to say that it's anywhere between 5 to 20% and then closer down to 5%. It was a very anachronistic understanding of what it meant to be literate. It was based on the ability from, I think it was the UNESCO definition from 1951, which is be able to read and write a sentence. But as anyone who's been in a doctoral program knows that, you know, you have to know German and you got to know French. And just because you can read a language doesn't mean you can write a language and, you know, all those types of things. So there are different scales of proficiency and that slide across the spectrum. One thing that graffiti helps us to see is we can see specifically the people who are really trained to write, because they're going to write in cursive and it's going to look very beautiful, versus those people that just scratch out more boxy type of letters that you would see on inscriptions, for example. It sort of opens that question up and sort of flips it on its head. There's a great line from a novel The Satyricon that was written around the time of Nero's reign, so in between AD 54 and 68. And the main character is a very pretentious, rich person who's gained Roman citizenship named Trimalco. And anyway, there's a slave of his that has a line in that text that says, "I know my letters carved in stone." And so it seems to suggest that there were people that could at least read the inscriptions, not necessarily all of the graffiti, but there were people who could at least read them. And then you couple that with the fact that a lot of inscriptions are formulaic. You know, they'll say sort of there's a formula to it, just like there's a formula we know when we see sincerely that we're reading a letter that has just been written, or dear, we're about to read a letter, or those types of things. Similarly with inscriptions, there's a lot of formula in inscriptions. And then there's the idea that, especially for a public inscription, a lot of these heralds would read out to the people. So you have some other scholars that say, and then there's the fact that people could just ask somebody, hey, can you read this inscription to me?
Yeah.
You know, so it's hard to put a definite number on that, but it seems to me that there were more people than just 5 to maybe 20% that could at least read inscriptions and some graffiti.
The other thing that I love about your book and some of the work that I've done is how all the different abbreviations that are used. We have these now in social media with BFF and LOL and FWIW. You know, we fill in the blanks, right? But they had that as well in these inscriptions, particularly as I remember. And correct me here if I'm wrong, but the Roman inscriptions seem to make a greater use of it than others.
The Romans were very proficient, and they're very conservative with their time, it seems like. And so they created the majority of abbreviations that you find, save for, I think, in Greek inscriptions, you'll find things like denominations of coins, those types of things that are abbreviated. But if you see, sometimes you see abbreviations of Greek inscriptions as evidence of Roman influence upon them, because they just, I mean, they abbreviated your first name, you know, in the three names that a Roman citizen have, that first name would be abbreviated with just the first letter. Tombstones, it was just DM, and you knew that was Dies Manibus and those types of things.
Yeah. So you see a lot of that. Well, let's bring it down now to the New Testament. Where do we see New Testament and inscriptions coming together? Give us an example of that. And your book is full of examples, I should say. We're talking about the book Studying the New Testament Through Inscriptions by Dr. Clint Burnett, an introduction. But your book is full of them. But let's talk at least about one of them and where you feel like there's good payoff from reading and seeing these inscriptions.
Yeah, so for me, I think the biggest payoff, but the thing people always comment on would be the 666 from the book of Revelation, from chapter 18. That's the one that when anyone talks to me about my book, they're like, okay, I like that chapter. that one was basically, you know, the disagreement is about whether or not when John says 666, it's the number of a man and his number is 666, whether or not John is talking about the culmination of evil, or whether or not he's actually trying to spell out a person's name. And since Adolf Deismann, who's an academic hero of mine, and he's done a lot of great work, especially in light from the ancient Near East, since him, there's been two inscriptions from Pompeii, two graffiti. And they both spell out the name of a woman that someone loves. And they spell out her name, I love the woman whose number is so-and-so, so-and-so. And that's just sort of in the standard. So the question that I had is, well, can we settle this dispute? How can inscriptions help us to do that? We have this exegetical impasse. We only have these two inscriptions. And then we have both these sides are saying, no, it's symbolic. Another, no, it's actually a person's name. And so I said, let me go back and let me do some research. And so I began to do some research. And I found a total of 21 other cases in which people's names were spelled with numbers. And on top of that, I found pretty compelling evidence that John follows a pan-Mediterranean formula when it comes to discussing these people. And so I think that's the one I can say that I'm pretty confident that 666 does spell a man's name.
Let's leave people sort of guessing at this point.
Okay.
They'll go out and leave your book. I am convinced, though, that you're right. And I think this Jewish practice of gematria, which is what it's associated with, is something that we see reflected in the New Testament. And not only in 666 and the number the number of the man that's described there, but also in other places like in Matthew's genealogy of Jesus, you have three groups of 14, and the number 14 is in Gematria the number of David, Daleth Vav Daleth. So you get at it really at the same level of that. And that seems to have been a common enough practice that particularly in an apocalyptic symbolic kind of text like Revelation, that we ought to be able to figure that out and sort that out. So if you want to know the identity of 666, you got to go to one of the last chapters. I don't remember which one. It's one of the last chapters in Clint Burnett's book, Studying the New Testament Through Inscriptions. Hey, this has been a fun. Thanks, Dr. Burnett, for being with us. Best of luck with the book. I know you have another one that I want to talk about at some point because I'm, as you know, I'm kind of interested in Christology just a little bit. But it's a book on the enthronement, as I recall, of Christ to the right hand of God. So is that book out?
It is, yeah. That is a substantially revised version of my doctoral dissertation. And it's essentially asks the question why Psalm 110:1 was latched onto, in the sense of we don't have if you want to say the word popular, I guess that would be the correct word, a popular Second Temple Messianic proof text, then all of a sudden with the rise of early Christianity, it's everywhere. Yeah. 21 times with allusions and quotations. And so basically I came up with what I thought was a proposal that it reflects a cross-cultural expectation of what happens to a beneficent, pious, and divinely appointed king in the first century. You get exalted next to the God. In this case, it would be the one true living God, the God of Israel. So I go through test cases and show that in pagan cults and those types of things, this was a pretty common occurrence to put the statue of a king next to a deity inside a temple.
So tell us the name of that book one more time.
I think that's Christ's Enthronement at God's Right Hand. Published by De Gruyter.
De Gruyter. Ah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's one of those expensive books then.
Indeed it is. I'm so sorry.
Well, I'll have to get one at the library, and then we can come get you when you come to see us, come get you to sign it. Been talking to Dr. Clint Burnett about his book, Studying the New Testament Through Inscriptions. Go out and get it, and you can find out the identity of 666. Clint, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Brent Johnson and Janet Seifert for editing these podcasts. Thanks as well to Phil Keggy for our music. These podcasts are made possible by the generosity of Mark and Becky Lanier and the Lanier Theological Library Foundation. If you have questions, comments, or would just like to be in touch, please email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is L-A-N-I-E-R. Thanks for listening.